Now the Three Martini Lunch with Greg Corumbus and Jim Garrity.
Welcome to the Monday edition of the Three Martini Lunch. And Jim, obviously in the last couple weeks here, this tax cut compromise between the president and congressional Republicans has gobbled up most of the political oxygen. Even votes on the DREAM Act and Don't Ask, Don't Tell have really paled in comparison to that. And to no one's surprise, the issue is also pretty prominent on the Sunday chat shows, including Fox News Sunday, where Chris Wallace was interviewing both Maryland Democrat Chris Van Hollen, who's got some issues with this, as well as incoming Budget Committee Chairman Paul Ryan. Chris Van Hollen made a little bit of news. He's still very upset with the estate tax provision. The idea that some rich families might actually get to keep some of that money is not very appealing to him. But he did say that he's not going to allow that to scuttle this whole thing on the House side.
Well, the fact of the matter is it was not central to the deal. And so then there's a simple question. We're not going to hold this thing up at the end of the day, but we do think that simple question should be put to the test.
We got some great audio from Paul Ryan in a moment here, so that's good news. That's our good martini that this probably won't get held up in the House. But this idea that a 35% estate tax is somehow a giveaway to the wealthiest Americans, a little bit puzzling.
Yeah, I think one of the things that's kind of interesting to see this is that there was a great deal of Sturm and Dang and all of this drama and tension. And you know, we talked last week about somebody using the F-bomb in reference to President Obama. If liberal Democrats really felt that strongly about it, you figure they'd pull out all the stops. And that came down to figuring out how to block the vote. They're not going to do that, which I think kind of signals that they know they're going to lose the vote. So this way they all get to be on the record as opposing it, but probably a combination of Democrats who are loyal to the president, a couple of blue dogs, the ones that are packing up their offices on the way out, and a coalition with them, the Republicans, are going to end up passing this. And there's a kind of surprising that if this doesn't trigger any real push for a liberal primary challenge to Obama, I think we can say that it's not going to come, because this has been a really big agenda item. And you can just kind of tell the tension in Van Hollen's voice of, well, we're giving up on this. We're going to have a vote on it, but deep down, we're not really going to win this fight. And so we're proceeding tactically as if we know that.
I think that's right. And I think Paul Ryan was sensing that and seizing on it, because in not just letting that pass, he says even the fact that you're putting up a fight over this shows that this class warfare ideology is really getting old and is not at all helpful.
Class warfare might make for good politics, but it makes for rotten economics. At the end of the day, we have to ask ourselves questions in this country. Are we interested in treating the symptoms of poverty and economic stagnation through income redistribution and class warfare? Or do we want to go at the root causes of poverty and economic stagnation by promoting pro-growth policies that promote prosperity?
So hopefully by caving in here, Jim, it would appear that the Democrats are not only losing on this particular vote, but losing also in the entire class warfare argument. Is it too early to say that?
Well, I was going to say, I think Ryan's being a little kind here. And I think you can argue that he says it makes terrible economics, but maybe good politics. I think after November, we can argue it's not that great politics anymore. I feel like this horse has been ridden about as far as it's going to ride. And, if anybody should know that, it should be Chris Van Hollen, who is running the DCCC. I mean, I'd be curious about what the DCCC Christmas party is like this year. Kind of a lot of high-fiving. Hey, guys, we kept it down to losing only 63 seats. You know, he knows how well that message sells out there on the campaign trail. I think what you're seeing the Democrats stick with it is because they don't have much beyond it. Once they concede that point to Ryan, that they want to see everybody prosper, that the rich are not evil, that one man's prosperity is not built on another man's impoverishment or struggling, what do they have? What do they need? You know, what do we need Democrats for, if not to express public envy? So I think that, you know, he's kind of being kind to them in one hand of overstating the value of the politics to it, and then two, kind of acknowledging, look, this is what the modern Democratic Party is about. You're never going to get anything beyond that from guys like Van Hollen, because that's who they are.
Well, let's move on to the second martini now, and let's call this not only the bad martini, but the coalition of the spurned and disillusioned gathering in New York today. People have basically been rejected or voted out of office. Christy Whitman is there. You've got Evan Bayh. You've got Mike Castle, who's getting on board with this. Basically, this is a group called No Labels. They're tired of partisanship. We need to move past partisanship. And they claim this is not a third political party, but it sure sounds like they might try to draft someone in the next presidential cycle here.
Actually, Greg, I'm pretty sure this is not a third political party, because to have a third party, you'd probably need something resembling coherence, and No Labels doesn't have that. They can call it No Labels. They can also call it No Platform, No Policy. This is a meeting group for people who are liberals, by and large, and who don't want to be called liberals anymore. And I think the only genuine Republican in good standing, you could argue, is Tom Davis. And I'm sure some people out there are probably snorting or chuckling as I say that. But most of the Republican office holders who are in this are people who either lost their primary, Bob Inglis and Mike Castle, or people who left the party, i.e. Mike Bloomberg and Charlie Crist. Now, every couple of years, there's this murmur of, we in the middle need something. And then you talk to the people in the middle and you find out that they're not really there's very little one from column A and one from column B. I think you find probably the very left fringe of the Republican Party, such as it is, and you find a bunch of other, you know, Democrats. Basically, it's Democrats in red states and, you know, the Republicans who are frustrated with their party. And no better example of this came. I tuned into the podcast or the webcast of their conference they're holding in New York City today. And the very first comment was about what the extremists are doing in Arizona and dividing us, referring to the immigration law.
Right.
Now, Greg, it's a phenomenally popular. Nothing has united Arizonans more than this immigration law that 70-some percent or 80-some percent like it and want to see the immigration laws enforced. Yet that is deemed an extremist position by an organization that right there in the name is No Labels. So what they mean is stop labeling us. We're free to label everybody else. And it's, you know, basically a it's getting each other in a circle and patting each other on the back about how open-minded and sensitive and noble everyone is. And unsurprisingly, it's not terribly effective. I think one of the probably my favorite comment came from an Iowa congressman who insisted that he was a proud Democrat, but because that's a label, he's also proud to be in a no-label household and a no-label town. I guess that town isn't on the map if it has no label. And then he says his favorite place in the House of Representatives is the gym because there are no labels there. Now, for me, that strikes me as a formula for a lot of exercise injuries. If none of the equipment has any labels on it, but I guess he meant partisan labels. But way to go, Iowa. You have one very fit congressman over there.
I guess so. Well, speaking of fit folks, you know, President Obama today talking about nutrition and, you know, kids being healthy. And that's important. The most important thing I thought was the fact that he's still president, because I wasn't sure about that on Friday when this little ditty went down in the White House briefing room.
Here's what I'll say is I've been keeping the first lady waiting for about half an hour, so I'm going to take off.
I don't want to make her mad. Please go.
You're in good hands. And Gibbs will call last question.
Yeah, help me. Thank you. Yeah, go ahead.
I love how Clinton's not fazed by that. I love how Clinton, for the first time ever in the White House, is worried about angering the First Lady.
You beat me to it.
And just the imagery of that was just so striking. It was just unbelievable that Clinton basically acted like he was taking over there.
Yeah, you know, I was unfortunately following this via Twitter. I wasn't able to watch this live on Friday afternoon, but everyone was just stunned by the surreality of seeing a you know, presidential press conference with former President Clinton there. And then Clinton kind of overtakes the podium. And then Obama, because he really, really needs to drink eggnog with Michelle, walks away, leaving Clinton, you know, answering questions. And apparently, you know, I think it was John Podoritz had looked into this. Every other previous time in the history of televised press conferences, when the president leaves, the event is over. And this one breaks with tradition because Bill Clinton is there and he just kept answering questions and answering questions. I want to know what he did afterwards. One, when that event ended, and then, you know, did he say, hey, Monica, you're not going to believe where I am right now? all kinds of, you know, I'm wondering, you know, did Obama come into the office this morning and find out we had bombed a Sudanese aspirin factory? You know, just how much into the groove did Clinton get that? So, and it was kind of, you know, the other reaction which everyone had was that Clinton had to know how bizarre it was to see a former president answering questions from the White House press corps as if he was president, and then he just kept doing it. Like, he knew that he was basically cutting the legs out from Obama. And, you know, there was, you said, this kind of strange chuckling of, well, Obama's kind of walked off the job. Are we subbing in now? Is this there's an Al Haig moment of somebody screaming, I'm in charge, I'm in charge?
Exactly right. I don't think, you're right, I think Clinton understood what he was doing was completely bizarre. I don't think it bothered him in the least. I think he still sees himself as the rightful holder of the office, that if that pesky 22nd Amendment hadn't gotten passed, he'd still be there.
I was just waiting for this closing line. Boy, didn't you miss me?
Yeah, who knows? He may still be there and just hasn't been back on camera yet. I guess we'll find out as the week progresses.
Early in this conversation, we talk about, you know, why there wasn't a liberal Democrat pushing Obama as a primary challenge. Well, I guess we found that primary challenger, huh? You know, all he's got to do is change the Constitution, and Bill Clinton will run for that third term he's always wanted.
Exactly right. Jim, a great way to start the week. We'll talk again tomorrow.
Looking forward to it, Greg. See ya.
Jim Garrity of NationalReview.com. I'm Greg Corumbus of Radio America. Join us tomorrow for the Tuesday edition of the 3 Martini Lunch.